actually. Yes. You are still using them for your goals, however you may rationalize them. And I think, you know, that we have to say, am I in this situation and am I getting myself involved and am I listening very closely to this proposition because I want to have my summer Negro? You know, to have a summer Negro is a rather despicable kind of thing in many ways, because people aren't meant for summers. They're meant to be dealt with from the entirety of their humanity and yours. So I hope that you think about this. This is just my opinion, of course, and you probably have some other ones. And of course, I'd say the same thing for all the cats who want to prove that they can have a white girl. Well, if you're really fighting for freedom in Mississippi, I don't think that having a white girl has anything to do with it. Because, you know, my summer Negro and the white girl that I made is no different from the token Negro in the school. It's still somebody who's just there to be seen, to be had, but not really being experienced and known. And besides, on this matter of the whole deal of our relationships along the line of our sexual expressions, I'd like those of you who are white and those of you who are Negro and who really feel that you're with us, say, Donnie, are you going to be able to say? Huh? Okay, because I'd like you to enter in after the break, okay? We're going to break in a few minutes. I'd like you to think about how, for instance, the Negro girls in Jackson or Meridian or Greenwood or Greenville feel. You know, here come these sweet chicks down from Radcliffe and the University of Chicago and the University of Michigan, and as soon as they walk in, all the fellows drop all around over them. And here have been these gals who've been struggling to make it, you know, for the last 18 or 19 or 20 years here in Greenville and Meridian and Macon. And all these chicks have to do is walk in and the guys just fall, often down in bed. How do you think these gals are going to feel? And I'd like to tell you that they know ways of getting at you for that. I think that we're going to have to really deal with human feelings and human experiences if we are supposedly involved in a movement that does deal with humans. And also, you know, we talk about the conservative Mississippians. Most of the Negroes in Mississippi are as conservative as the whites, and especially the older people who many of you will be staying with. They may not have been as, you know, released from sexual inhibitions as you have been. And how you deal with their feelings concerning this matter is a very, very important issue. We will not be able to walk as if we are alone in this situation. We will not be able to walk as if we are secluded and separated entities in this situation. We are a part of the movement. And what we do had better have something to do with the movement that we are a part of. That's for now. You can, you know, throw your books later on. On this matter of how you respond to black racism, all I can say is, you know, recognize where it comes from, recognize why it's there, recognize that one of the reasons why it's there is because people have not been accepted, people have not been told that they are good, and therefore they have to tell themselves that they are good, especially good. And maybe one of the ways of dealing with it is to let them know that you think that they're great, simply because they're human. Secondly, in dealing with black racism, recognize that black racism is there because of your white racism. And recognize that no matter how many times you come to Mississippi, you're probably going to be bringing some along with you. And, you know, admit this. The plague, as Bob said, none of us. So if we can, you know, say, yeah, baby, I know that you think that black is great, but there's a little bit in me that thinks that white is great too. Well, you know, you can get a dialogue going, and the Indians may win. Well, like it sometimes. Especially after some of these black racist cats have hit you on the head a few times. You want to find some Negroes who think that you're pretty good. All right? That's true. You're going to feel that way, but don't give in to it too often. Because that's why the situation is as it is now, because there are a lot of black people all over the South and the North who want to feel that way. And feeling that way at the expense of somebody else is bad.
An address given by Reverend Vincent Harding of the Mennonite Church of Atlanta, Georgia, at the Oxford, Ohio orientation. Betty and Pete, this tape, liberal part of Mississippi, even more liberal than Jackson. And she got very emotional and really disturbed everybody at the meeting because she said, this is a revolution and you're a band of revolutionaries and that you can expect the fate of revolutionaries when you walk across when you cross the border of Mississippi, you are in mortal danger. And then she started to talk about the boys and she broke off and couldn't speak anymore. It set a very unhappy tone to the meeting, and everybody drifted out very quietly, talking amongst themselves and sort of searching their motives. As one of the leaders had said, now is the time to make up your minds. If you don't want to stay, you're welcome to go. No one's going to think ill of you if you leave. And there's other work that you can do and so forth. And it was interesting as we were walking through the summer night to hear some of the conversations that were quietly going on. Behind me, the Episcopalian minister was talking with a young boy, and he was saying, motives, how do I know what my motives are? How does anyone know his motives? You help an old lady across the street, what's your motive? Do you do it out of the kindness of your heart, or do you want to be seen, or you're trying to get a merit badge? And he said, most likely it's all three. All motives are mixed, and if you start examining your motives, it cripples your action. And But the second day, today, was much better. The atmosphere was much better, much more alive. We had a Negro boy from Mississippi led the singing, and real live singing. And we were shown ways to defend ourselves, and we were also told some of the hopeful things in the state. For instance, there are some very prominent youngsters in the state. I guess that one of them is the son of a senator. His father does not particularly want him to be down here. And so because of the pressure that's been placed on the president and the federal government, the Justice Department has sent down some men who have actually, for the first time, they say, in the state of Mississippi, have the first time have defended the interests of the people who have been beaten up instead of the people who are doing the beating. And even a few arrests have been made. This is unprecedented down here. And workers here, the SNCC workers, hope that even when we leave, it may somehow set a precedent and change the atmosphere in the state of Mississippi. Anything else, Bonnie?
I just wanted to add that we found out another interesting fact. Most of the Negro people in the rural areas are armed and are not really believers in nonviolence. They're going along with this nonviolent program because they feel if some good comes out of it, that'll be wonderful, but they are also prepared to defend themselves and their homes. Also to defend us, they're taking a big risk in having us come into their homes. Another very enheartening fact we learned today was that there are going to be over 1,000 people participating in this program, which is very wonderful indeed, because we were feeling a little discouraged. There was an estimate of 500 given. They've also got over 1,000 children who are enrolling, and we find out that they're children who are between 10th and 11th grade. And contrary to what we were told before, we have discovered that many of them are very bright children and really had some very fine education from the Negro teachers in this area. Let's see. By the way, we've been staying in a very interesting place. It's an old Civil War hospital. We live in the Negro part of the city, and it has a great deal of charm. We haven't seen downtown Memphis yet. We hope we will before we leave. But we have nothing but praise for all the wonderful treatment we've had from the Negro people here and from the other wonderful people who are partaking in the program. By the way, we would like to have our children hear this, Betty, if it's possible, and I'd just like to give you my daughter and son's telephone number if you should play this tape.
You said you told us a very interesting story last night about your reactions to the first white civil rights workers who came down here. Can you repeat that, please?
Well, it was back in 1961, and when the project first began in Mississippi, in southwest Mississippi, Macomb, was the headquarters. And we only had one staff person on the staff at the time, who was Bob Delman, southern white person from Alabama. So Bob came down. We had about five staff people.
Uh-huh.
And I was just beginning in the movement, and I was sort of afraid of him, you know. White person and all the white people I was and all were the people that call you the dirty name and beat you up. So I just sort of avoided him. Didn't talk to him. And I never talked to him, until we got arrested together and we went to jail and we were there together and with no one else to talk to but one another. And I just sort of forgot the fact that he was white. And I think it's sort of what is happening in the movement all over. People, young Negro in the South are coming around to accepting the white people who are coming South to work. It's not going to be an overnight thing, but it's going to be a thing that happens gradually when people are able to live together and slowly talk together and find out that this is another human being like himself, not just the myth that we have of white people, that they're all evil, they're all ready to hit you over the head. They're all ready to call you nigger.
Okay. Do you know Mike Miller of San Francisco? He was down here last year.
Yeah. I met Mike a long time ago. I met him in Atlanta. And I was in Mississippi when he first came. Mike is a good boy. He worked in Greenwood. And at the time, he was one of the first whites, or one of the first two whites, one of the two whites, rather, who came to Mississippi after Bob Zellner. Bob Zellner had a hard time because we were beaten bad, and we were afraid to use white people in Mississippi. So it was about 2 years before we used them again. But when we did finally use them, Mike was one of the people that came. But at the time, we confined whites to the office, left them inside of the office, and they couldn't go outside. The area was no place but from the office to where they live and to where they eat. It was pretty hard, but now it's different. It was very hard then, and I think Mike feel good about being one of the person to break the ice.
You told us an interesting story the other night, Mr. Hayes, about the fact that Mike was put to sweeping the floors and what else was it?
Yeah, he had to sweep floors and wash dishes and, you know, do all the stuff.
And the effect that had on the Negro people around him to see a white person do such menial labor.
Yeah, it's the, all the Southern Negro know about whites is that, you know, we go to and work, we keep their house clean, mm-hmm. and we wash their dishes, and we wash their clothes, and we iron their clothes, and we farm their land, and we tend their garden, we work their flowers, and they sit down.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the whole thing. Now, to counteract that, and then in a way, I think Mike kind of took it on himself. He recognized this, that, you know, people walked around and said, Mr. Miller instead of Mike, you know, and they said, Mr. Fry, you know, it was hard. And instead of saying, don't say mister, instead of saying, I'm just another human being, it was sort of the old saying my grandmother used to say, actions speak much louder than words.
That's
sit
right.
down and sweep some floors and wash some dishes. And they talk like you from down yonder.
Yeah.
It had a tremendous effect on the people, and it meant a lot.
And what do you think is the value of our coming down like this to Mississippi? Do you think there's a great value in it? Will there be any lasting value in it?
Well, that's a very good question. It's very hard to answer. It's definitely some lasting value. But the reason I say it's hard to answer is hard to itemize or to enumerate and put your finger on exactly what's so good about it, except for the fact that it is going to do something for the image the Negroes have of white. It's going to do something. I think a lot of people, this is changing, but a few years ago, a lot of Negroes felt that he was kind of obligated to take part in the movement because whites were involved, and that this was not white people's fight. This was not their fight, but they were involving themselves anyway. But this is not altogether true now. They don't think this way. Now they think that the whites, even the whites of today, are responsible for the predicament we're in. They're responsible just because of the fact that they're white. Not that they were the ones that brought us from Africa and put us in chains. Not that they were the one that wrote the Constitution, but they are white. You know, for the same reason that we must get, that Negroes must go out and go to jail and fight for what they think is right, and our parents could have done it and didn't do it, is the same reason whites should do it. You know, and the fact that whites can come in large numbers and do it, say something that gives some hope. The fact that the Negro only constitutes 1/10 of the United States population. It gives hope that there are other people other than that 1/10 who are concerned about this country and who feel that this 20 million people has to make some advancement, that they are being depressed and that they you know, that something should be changed. Now, if only the 20 million people were concerned, the hope would be much less. Because what is 1/10 of the population? You know, 1/10 of the population is being depressed, yes, but there's another 9/10 who's not necessarily interested. You know, no hope. You know,
mm-hmm.
the hope is gone. But when whites come to say something, to say that somebody else in that other 9/10 of this population are concerned about what's going on. Now, the other thing is that in the long run, it's going to mean that a lot of, see, this thing is going to have a lot of momentum. A lot of people are going to have to understand exactly what the movement is trying to do. Most people sit around, you mention civil rights, all they think of is integrating the lunch counter, integrating the school, integrating a community. But they never think of the educational value involved. They never think of just how important this is in relevance to keeping this nation alive, or keeping this nation a democracy, let's say, of making it what it should be. They don't see this connection. They just see that here are some people who want to eat with whites, who want to live with whites, and want to go to school with whites. But they don't understand why this is necessary for a constitutional democracy.
You mean the Negro people don't recognize it?
Not only the Negro people, mm-hmm. but the people in the United States, mm-hmm. they don't understand what the movement is about. Now, the more people that are involved, the more people that are able to go back and tell the story, exactly how these people talk and what they talk about down south and how they live, you know, and how it's spread and how sick the whites are in the south and how sick the political structure is and just how hard and rigid it is and how hard it's going to be to break. You know, to understand, you know, how deep this thing is going to mean a lot in the long run. That people can, you know, just imagine 1,000 people in Mississippi this summer would be able to go back and maybe tell another 1,000, each one tell 1,000
uh-huh.
of exactly what's going on.
Uh-huh.
You know, first-hand yes. experience.
That's right.
This is going to mean something.
Not only that, but the fact of 1,000 people here personally involves the parents and the children and the relatives and the friends of each person, and involves them in a personal way in which they've never before been involved in a struggle like this. Suddenly it touches them where it hurts.
Yeah.
Well, and also I was thinking the effect on the children. Now, say 1,000, you know, I don't know if we're all going to be freedom teachers, but say that about 1,000 children will be taught, right?
More.
Well, this is the younger generation, and the bolder, the younger they are, the bolder they'll be, because after all, life is moving forward. And it seems to me that we can mutually, the teachers can help the children and give them courage and give more courage to fight in the future. And they can help us to give us understanding and faith in the children of the future. Don't you think so?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
What was I going to ask you?
Well, I think you were sort of interested in the jails that were in the...
Oh, yes, you were telling about the jails, right.
I don't, well, see, last night I just sort of mentioned two incidents in particular that to sort of stress what's going on. But in a lot of cases, we've had a lot of people who come out of jail and had to see psychiatrists afterwards.
Yeah.
Now, this was an incident in 1961 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. One of Snake Field's secretaries went down. And he was placed in jail where he was kept for about 69 or 70 days. And what they did in this jail, they had about four different sections, and he made it round his rounds during his time there. They had solitary confinement. Solitary confinement, yes. And they had the hot box. They had the homosexual wards, and then they had the regular wards, the regular cells. When they first put him in, they put him in solitary confinement for about 3 or 4 days, fed him water and bread. They took him out and they put him in a nice bed and a cell, and they fed him chicken, steak, and stuff that he really liked. You know, anything he liked, he got it. They kept him in there about 2 days and put him in the ward for the hot box, and it's about 112 to 120 degrees. They kept him there about 3 or 4 days, feed him very little. Then took him out and put him in a homosexual ward. Left him in there about a week and took him out and put him in an ICE cell again. And they never stopped this. The whole 70 or 69 days he was there, they went over and over, back and forth. And when he got out, he was just really out of his mind.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Is this same treatment given to the white civil rights workers who come down to the South to work, or is this reserved especially for the Negroes?
It's hard to say at the time. In this particular day, it all depends on where the town is. In Baton Rouge, at the same time, Bob Zellner, who I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. was there too. Same sort of treatment didn't happen to Bob Zellner. He was switched around a little bit from solitary confinement to good cells. But he was never put in the homosexual ward. Now he was put in the hard box. but he had a hard time because he had all white inmates, and he always got water thrown on him, and he got beat and stuff like that. Now, it differs because of the inmates. Negroes are with Negro inmates, and they're not going to get beat by inmates most of the time anyway. But whites do have this to be afraid of.
Why don't you mention something more specific about the homosexual ward that you put there for purposely bother you?
Well, yes, he was bothered. He was.
You can't hear my question, so why don't you mention it?
I think that can be heard, Annie. The question is, do they bother you in the homosexual wards? The purpose of putting you there is so that they'll molest you, especially if you're a youngster.
Yes, eventually, a suit tried to be filed, but I don't think it was ever filed. I had doctors to examine him, and he had been molested, and he had been tampered with, and so on. This was the purpose, this was the main idea. There's nothing in the ward but homosexuals, and this was the only reason he was put there. Now, another case, in Pike County, located in the southwest Mississippi, is now considered the most dangerous area in Mississippi because of the 60,000 armed vigilantes they have there, because of the fact that 5 people have been killed in the last 8 weeks.
What specific area was
it? It was Macomb, Mississippi. Now, in this jail, what I mentioned yesterday was they took about 11 of us once and put us in a drunk tank that was about 12 by 12. It was all concrete, completely concrete, beds and walls and windows and everything else. It was dark at all times. And the joint was a hole in the floor, and the water to be drank came out of the wall and into the joint. And we were kept there for about 11 days or 8 days or something like that. And there wasn't room. 2 people had to sleep on one of those concrete beds, or either on the floor. Everything was concrete, so it didn't matter too much. And they brought you in food without anything to eat with, just on stuff on a plate, and you ate it with your hands.
They
have food that comes leftover food from cafeterias in the city. That's where this jail is there. We'd have grits, cold grits. And bread, stale bread for breakfast, sort of bread. No, this wasn't the place. And we had 2 meals a day, and the next meal we'd always have beans and bread. That's all. And up in Indianola, Mississippi, which is in the Delta, in a sort of different area, and Indianola is located in Sunflower County, where Senator Easton home is. They only have 1 ward there for Negroes, and so they just put all the prisoners there, regardless what you've done, whether it's misdemeanor, criminal, or anarchy or something, you're all there together. And this says it was a very nasty place. They never cleaned it up. The mattresses were just gone. The floors were just filthy. The bathtub was filthy. The joint was filthy. Everything was just completely filthy. And they bring this food up in a big pot, and they sit it out in the middle of the floor there, and it's filled with beans and bread and plates and spoons and cups to drink water with, and all of it is dumped into the beans. The beans are cooked in the pot, and then they just dump everything else over in the pot with the beans, the plates, the spoons, the bread, and the cups. And sometimes it's some 30 to 40 prisoners in there, and everybody go in and dip their plate out with their hands and find their silverware. Find the bread, and find the cups, and dip everything out and eat. And unless you can fast for 2 or 3 months, you don't have much choice.
Tell me, Mr. Hayes, do you think that there'll be any real success in the voter registration efforts this summer? It seems to be terribly difficult to register anyone. Not only the fear of registration, but the difficulty of the rules. That's all.
Yes, I know what you're asking, but I'm not sure I want to answer.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm going to ask you a question. But I think it's when you ask whether there's going to be success or something important that has to be understood as far as the project goes. And I don't think everyone realized just how important Southwest Mississippi is. And it only consists of six counties. But it is important. And it is going to determine whether this whole summer project is a success or not. It will be the place that determines whether it is a success. Now, and I get back to the voter registration and how complicated it is and so on. Southwest Mississippi, as I have mentioned, is now considered the most dangerous area in Mississippi. Presently, we are going to have 12 staff people going there to work, sort of guinea pigs, sort of to see if it's possible to work there at all, see if it's too dangerous to work there at all. Now,
may I ask you at this time, is there going to be any effort made to send down these people who are doing the civil rights work into this area, or is it too early?
People who are going to be doing civil rights work?
Yes.
Well, these people are doing...
I'm going to get to that if you let me, let me finish. Now, we can't send voluntary workers into Southwest Mississippi. We can't because it is too dangerous and nobody knows, they don't know the area and their chances of staying alive are near, very near. Now, I've mentioned that there are 60,000 vigilantes armed with M1 rifles and hand grenades, and it is known. I don't know if I mentioned that some five homes have been bombed in the last 6 weeks. Some five people have been killed in this area in the last 8 weeks. And if you notice, nobody's heard about these five killed people because they were all Negroes. They were all local Negroes. They weren't from New York, like the two people that were killed down in, were missing down in Philadelphia. And this Negro in Philadelphia would not have been mentioned if these people were not white and were not from New York. And this is to be understood. It is bad that this has to happen. Now, it's good that these people did receive national attention, yes. I'm not saying that that's not good. But I'm saying that the others should, too. People have been killed every day, and nobody knows about it in Mississippi. Now, this is the area where it is happening. Now, they are not saying in Southwest Mississippi that we're going to make it hard for the workers. They are saying we're going to kill the workers when they get here. We're not going to even let them start working.
Uh-huh.
Yesterday, we sent workers in, and I'm leaving this evening going down for
the
morning.
You're going down there?
Yeah, I'll be working there. It's my home. Now if it is impossible to work in Southwest Mississippi, then we may as well forget the whole summer project. We may as well forget Mississippi, period, because it is going to say to the rest of the county, all you have to do is do what we did. You do what we did and you stop the whole project.
Mm-hmm.
And if Mississippi can do it, then Alabama is going to say, if you do what we did, it stops the whole project.
Mm-hmm.
And so can Arkansas and so can the whole United States say it. You know. So this is a very crucial area. It is crucial that we go there. And it is crucial it is going to be the life and death of the movement in Mississippi. Southwest Mississippi is going to be a life or the death of Mississippi. Now, if we can work in Southwest Mississippi, then there are chances that the summer project would be good. Now, the things that has to be knocked down, the statutes that exist there, that are so obviously unconstitutional, is the requirement for registering to vote. And, you know, and I think it was what you were asking. Number one, you have to pass this literacy test that consists of 21 questions. Now, this includes an interpretation of the Constitution, a section of the Constitution. It includes giving the duties and obligations of a citizen, and it includes copying a section of the Constitution, which are the three questions on the application that the applicant has failed. Now, law school students have been known to
fail.
Obligation of a citizen, and it includes copying a section of the Constitution, which are the three questions on the application that the applicant has failed. Now, law school students have been known to
fail.
Teachers have been known to fail Doctors have been known to fail. Lawyers have been known to fail. Now, the thing is, the other thing is that you must have good moral character to be a registered voter. And this says that any person who attempts to register to vote, his vote, his name must be printed in the papers for 30 days, 7-day intervals. And if anyone recognizes his name...
Oh, my God.
And anyone recognizes his name, can call the registrar and say, I don't think John Doe has good moral character, and he doesn't become a registered voter. At the same time, this make possible for the Klan, the Citizen Council, Fire Commission, any vigilantes to recognize the individual's name and address.
Mm-hmm.
And if he has a job, get him fired. If they want to kill him, they can kill him. That's number two. And number three is that any person, these other things that's going to make activities hard, not the requirements, but just going to make it hard for people to get people, to influence people to register. Now these are some new laws that have come into existence this year. One of them says that people come into the state to advocate social change. You know, this is a crime. To come to the state to advocate social change.
Is that a misdemeanor?
No, it's a criminal.
A felony.
The other is, now I'm glad you mentioned that because it's important that you notice that that if any workers are arrested, it is going to be a criminal charge. I want you to remember that. Mm-hmm. That any workers arrested, it's going to be
a
criminal charge.
She's 11 years old, and she's in the Freedom School at Mount Zion Church. Lynette, tell me about your Freedom Notebook.
I wrote them because I wanted to go down in history when I go to Washington. I want to show them to the President of the United States.
You want to have them published too, don't you?
Yes.
Yesterday you said you wanted to make history, is that right?
Yes.
why don't you read me the little essay you wrote, Lynette?
Today we are engaged in a great battle that will long endure and keep this nation or any nation from becoming free. We should, as long as we live, try not to be afraid of this man or any man, no matter what color he may be. We are engaged in a sense of reality and human rights that will long be a part of this world as long as we live and as long as we can use our human rights. In slavery times are very hard for our great-grandparents, who then had a bad and even a better opportunity of becoming free. Now we have a better chance, no matter how bad or how dangerous, we can continue to fight for freedom.
Thank you, Lynette. Go hear how you sound. What's your name, dear?
Gwendolyn Bowen.
Tell me what you told in class the other day when we had a show and tell, and you told about how you went to Nathan Crescent.
Well, we had to go to town with my sister, and we went in Crescent, and I brought a Coca-Cola, me and my friend. And we sit down, and the police was just looking at us, and all the white folks, as they were passing by. And I didn't pay them any attention. I just kept on drinking my Coca-Cola. And when we got up, all the folks were just looking, and I was kind of nervous when I first sit down. I didn't, because it was my first time eating, and I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to find.
Right. What's your name, dear?
Carla Veja.
All right. What have you got to tell?
About the Negroes. The Negroes used to have to go down to the back, but now they can go to the front. To the bus station, they can go to the front.
Isn't that nice? Anybody else have anything to say?
I do.
Go ahead. Tell me your name, dear, and tell me what you have to say.
My name is Stephanie Vaughn. My friend...
How old are you, honey?
I am 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
My friend, Shirley Funchesville, she wanted to go to the bathroom one day, and so we went in Woolworths. While we was in there, it was two white women. They came in there, and when they saw that it was four of us, so we went in there, and when they saw that it was four Negroes, and then they turned around and went out.
And what did you think?
Well, I thought that they didn't want us to use their bathroom.
Did you care?
No, ma'am.
Let them go out then, it's their hard luck.
And when we went out, they came back in.
Oh, they'll get over it, won't they? They have to go to the toilet stand, not they'll go anyway. just terrible. Damon, how old are you?
Oh, my name is Rosemary Andrews. I'm 11 years old.
Tell us something, honey.
You know, we was coming back from Morgan Lee's one day.
Same deal
one day. Well, he was a white boy. He was in the woman. He said, he told us, where were these niggas going? And so all of us looked back and, we kept walking. And then we looked back at him. He kept seeing, looking at the woman, said, where are you niggas going? Green and Green Dawn looked back and said, we going home. He like, it ain't none of your business. Where we going?
What's your name, darling, and how old are you?
Helen Jones, and I am 11 years old.
Go ahead, sweetie.
One day we was coming home from Freedom School, and we went in Preacher's Store, and we sung We Shall Overcome, and we was hot, and we asked him for a cigar box, and he said he didn't have none, and he did have one. And Jess didn't want to give now, so we came out of his stock and all them people were looking at us.
Yeah, okay. What's your name, dear?
Justin Dwight Jr.
How old are you, honey?
10.
Tell me your story.
Well, my sister's the only way to Jackson. So they went in the bathroom, in the white bathroom, and so the police station man, he went and locked the door, and they had to wait till he unlocked the door.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to tape a class, and then when we come out of class, all the kids wanted to get on tape again, so we're all gathering outside, and everybody who has anything to say is going to get it off his chest.
Solving the problem of the Negroes, but one of the most logical is the they had used nonviolence to convert the people, if they had used violence, it wouldn't have only proved that they wanted to, they didn't want their religion. They just wanted to get something to say that what they would, they would have to go to church or something like that.
Yeah.
killed, therefore destroying his national image. You said that all of us would be killed and couldn't enjoy this freedom. It was talking about Christianity. Whether or not that the Crusades to the Holy Land, were they nonviolent? Did the men rattled and then lay down and then somebody beat them with their swords? No, they fought back against what was right and there. You said organized violence is a we said organized violence is a mean of self-defense and retaliation. It is not knowing yourself with someone. Who's going to think when someone has killed a member of their family? Who's going to think about being nonviolent? The first thing you're going to think about is getting revenge. That's not the first thing that you're going to do when you talk about nonviolence. That's out of the question. If someone kills someone that you love, you're not going to think about being nonviolent toward them. Regardless of who's going to say on anybody, you're not going to think about degrading yourself. You're going to think about getting personal revenge. You were talking about nonviolence in St. Augustine. What was really achieved there? Nothing. You were talking about picketing. I haven't seen anything yet that picketing has really accomplished, except cause some heavy fines to hurt you more than help you because you're going around, you don't have any clothes to wear, no food to eat or anything else. It hurts you more than it helps you. What can you say except that violence is the only thing that you can resolve to? Oh, my name is Clarence Whitney. Now we're going to have open discussion among
you have a right to defend yourself. You stand the right to defend yourself. Father, we come to thee. Help us way that we know how. Put us in the doubt of our Creator, our Maker, and our Redeemer. So come to thee, O God, as a picture before the whole mountain. Father, the burden of the heavens around us.